Good morning. We're delighted to welcome you all to the COI. We have with us a group of students who I'd like to recognize. Would the Whitefish Bay High School students please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. Students are here with a program cleverly entitled Court with Class. It's sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court. We invite students from around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. If the students agree to come, they are sent materials about the case and listen to the oral argument. And at the end of this second oral argument in the morning, the students meet with a justice who's been assigned for the day to meet with the students. The discussion is on the procedures the court uses to take cases and decide cases. There is no discussion of the substantive issues of the case. Everyone is invited to join the students and the justice during the lunch hour. If anyone here would like a copy of a summary of the case, if you'd raise your hand, the marshal will give you a summary. Seeing no hands raised, I'll go to the next order of business, which is to introduce the court. I'm Shirley Abrahamson. I'm the Chief Justice, and I will be the justice with whom the students meet today at the end of this hearing. To my left is an empty chair. Justice Crooks will not be participating. Seated next to the empty chair is Justice Pat Rogensack. Seated next to her is Justice Michael Gableman. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Next to her is an empty chair of Justice David Prasa, who is not sitting on this case. And next to the empty chair on the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I will call 10 AP 1812 State versus Demetrius Anagnos. Is that the way he pronounces his name? Okay. Arguing on behalf of the state is Assistant Attorney General Michael C. Sanders. Counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Michael Sanders, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin in this matter. There are two issues in this case. The first issue is whether reasonable suspicion or probable cause to stop a vehicle is an issue at a refusal hearing. This court has already held that the issues at a refusal hearing are limited to those listed in the implied consent statute, 343-305-9A5. And that they include only whether the officer had probable cause to believe the person had committed an OWI-related offense, whether the person was lawfully placed under arrest for an OWI-related offense, whether the person refused chemical testing, whether the officer read the implied consent warnings, and whether the person refused testing, and whether the person was incapable of submitting to testing. The Court of Appeals in this case concluded that as part of whether the person was lawfully placed under arrest for an OWI-related offense, that includes whether the officer had reasonable suspicion or probable cause to stop the vehicle. The state asked this court to hold that is not the case.
What's not the case?
That whether the person was lawfully placed under arrest includes whether the officer had reasonable suspicion to stop the vehicle.
What does the state want to be decided at the proceeding?
Only what is listed in Section 343, 305, 985.
What was listed was lawful arrest. Mm-hmm. All right.
In the case of a traffic, in the case of an arrest on the street, all that is required for an officer to lawfully place a person under arrest is that the officer has probable cause and that the officer does those things that an officer has to do to put a person under arrest, meaning the officer intends to restrain the person, the officer actually does restrain the person, and the person understands that he or she has been restrained.
And there has to be probable cause.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So you agree, I gather, that the subject of whether the arrest was lawful is a proper subject of this proceeding.
Yes.
All right. What you don't agree with, if I understand this, is that, well, let me ask you it this way. Can you have an illegal stop and then put the person under arrest? Is that arrest lawful? If, as a result of the illegal stop, you get evidence that gives you probable cause?
I don't think that under this statute that comes into play.
I didn't ask you that.
Okay.
I want to know, in an ordinary case, let's take it away from the statute for a moment.
So it's not a refusal case.
Can you have a good arrest if the initial stop and the initial evidence that's taken in the stop are bad? Doesn't that affect the arrest?
It would affect whether evidence is going to be suppressed, certainly.
Right. Well, maybe would it affect the arrest if the initial stop is bad? If they go into the house?
If they go into a house, I think we're talking about, I understand that.
I'm trying to get them to where the initial proceeding is, we agree, is bad. An arrest is made. Is that arrest subject to challenge?
I suppose it could be subject to challenge.
Are you going to win? Will the defendant win on the challenge? Anything subject to challenge?
Not completely clear.
Pardon me?
I'm not completely clear. If you would win, I would assume it would depend on the circumstances of the case.
Certainly.
The only case that we dealt with here, or that the defendant dealt with, was State v. Welsh, which I don't believe, or Welsh v. Wisconsin, which I don't think has any bearing on this case, because there the issue was simply whether the arrest was lawful.
And went as into the house.
Right, and as the dissent in this court said, and as the U.S. Supreme Court said, the arrest itself wasn't lawful because
was not.
It was done in the house without exigent circumstances.
Because the cops were in a place that they couldn't make the arrest.
Right. Here the officers were on the street. And on the street, all that is required under case law and a lot of statutes, and at least three Wisconsin statutes, is that the officer has probable cause to arrest and does those things that are necessary to effect the arrest.
I thought he was in a car.
He was not in a home.
Okay.
I said on the street at the time he was arrested. I guess I'm not 100% sure if he was in the car or next to his car.
All right.
He was driving a car. Certainly, yes.
Right. They stopped the car, right? To me, that's comparable to going to a house. Now, they're different rules, but can cops stop the car anytime they want?
They can stop the car if they have reasonable suspicion or probable cause.
Right. If they have no reasonable suspicion, can they make a lawful arrest?
I think they can.
Pardon me?
I think they can, but the evidence might be suppressed later if the stop wasn't valid. But I don't think it matters in this case.
Okay. Why?
Because the implied consent statute isn't meant to get at that. This court has ruled twice on what comes up as to what is supposed to happen at a refusal hearing. And it's never given any indication that whether the stop was okay comes up at that hearing.
Counsel, it's been my experience anyway that typically the OWI proceeds along and has all its motions, and the refusal ticket kind of tags along with the OWI. And then once the OWI is dispensed with one way or the other, then the refusal ticket could be dismissed or dealt with in one way or another. Why do you think that might be the practice in some jurisdictions, if not a number of them?
That might be the case because it's easy, but that's not what the statute says, I don't think.
Do you think it's because in the OWI, for example, if the evidence is suppressed, then they'll deal differently with the refusal hearing ticket, and that the OWI is the area in which the suppression motion for the stop should be made?
I think that that's the case. I think according to the way the statute reads, they are two completely separate things. And whether the evidence is suppressed for the purposes of the OWI doesn't really have any bearing on the refusal.
Because let's say, for example, a defendant wanted to litigate the refusal and they lost the refusal. There are significant penalties that are imposed from losing a refusal.
Sure.
Whereas if you go ahead and try the OWI and you win or lose that, then you can negotiate what you want to do with the refusal. So it's atypical, at least in my experience, to have seen the refusal dealt with first, because the suppression and other issues have more typically been dealt with in the OWI matter. If you lose the refusal, it's almost...
If the state loses or if the defendant loses?
If the defendant loses the refusal hearing, there are significant penalties. It almost...
Well, sure. He is going to lose his license, and the fact of the refusal can be admitted at trial on the drunk driving charge. Sure. But I don't think that means that the defendant is able to essentially bring two suppression motions, one at the first hearing, which could happen first according to the way the statute reads, so that he can essentially move to suppress on the refusal hearing and bring up everything that leads up to the stop. Then if he loses...
If the sheriff
also bring it up later.
If the sheriff did the arrest, they're all going to be in circuit court. That would be a neat little package.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say you have a local law enforcement officer do the arrest, the refusal ticket's in municipal court,
mm-hmm.
and then you have the OWI in mm-hmm. maybe municipal court, but maybe not. What impact would a municipal court judge's ruling on a refusal have on the other judge trying the OWI?
If the municipal judge finds that the refusal was proper, then the person is going to lose his license, and the state can admit that was improper. I'm sorry.
I knew what you meant.
The person is going to lose his license, and the fact that he refused can be admitted at trial.
But let's say what happened here happens before a municipal court.
Well, if the judge had only ruled on the refusal case right. and not made it into a two-pronged hearing, then the state would not be able to admit the evidence of a refusal at the trial for the drunk driving because it didn't come in. It's not exactly clear what would happen depending on what the court ruled.
Do you think the municipal court, let's say it's a different municipal court judge, would have to dismiss the OWI based upon the other judge's refusal determination?
No. I mean, it might happen. It would depend in part on why. I would think if the municipal court found, for instance, that the officer had failed to read the form properly, and that's why the refusal was proper and the refusal was then thrown out, I don't know why that would have any bearing on the drunk driving case. But if it was a if the municipal court judge determined that there wasn't probable cause, then that might have a bearing on the drunk driving. I think that makes sense.
Would that be issue preclusion?
I think it depends in it might depend in part on which way it worked. If the municipal court judge found that there was probable cause, for instance, and that the refusal was not proper, I don't think the state could then rely on that in the drunk driving context, because the first one in the municipal court, say, is a hearing where the defendant doesn't have the right to a lawyer, and it's a lower standard for what is probable cause. At a refusal hearing, as this court has stated in State v. Nordness, the determination of probable cause is only one of plausibility of the officer's account. The court doesn't weigh evidence. In this case, the court did. It heard evidence from the defendant, and technically, I don't even know if it should. It's not there to weigh evidence. It only says, did the officer give a plausible account such that he had probable cause to believe that the person had violated one of the specified offenses, and that's it. It's a very quick hearing. It's a very easy hearing. There's not really much to it. It's not meant to be a full evidentiary hearing where the defendant has the right to a lawyer and the court weighs evidence. It's supposed to take half an hour. It's supposed to be quick. And in this case, it turned into a three-day hearing over 3 months. It's not really the way it's supposed to work, I don't think.
Is the refusal hearing a criminal hearing or a civil
no.
hearing?
It's a special proceeding.
So it's not governed by the laws of criminal procedure.
Right. There is no right to an attorney, no right to discovery unless the court wants to grant it. And the standard is such that it is just a plausibility standard, not a full probable cause standard as you would have at the drunk driving case.
Okay. And since the so the state, obviously, as they did here, has a right to appeal, where if you went through a full OMBWI, the state doesn't have a right to appeal if they lose.
Depending on the issue.
On the issue,
yes.
Yeah. Suppression, you can always appeal.
Sure.
That's true. Okay, thank you. You keep saying no right to counsel. You mean no right to appointed counsel by the state?
Oh, yes, sure. Yes. Yeah, you can have an attorney. In this case, he did. So, I mean, you can, but you don't have the right to it, to have counsel appointed if you can afford it. I think what is important to look at in terms of the statute is that the statute really starts upon the arrest. It's not about the stop or anything leading up to it. Or it starts with the arrest. According to sub 2 of the statute, a person who operates a vehicle in the state has consented to give a test sample. Under sub 3, the officer can request a sample only after an arrest for one of the specified offenses, which I termed an OWI-related offense. Under sub 4, the officer who asks for the sample has to read certain information to the person, which says, you have been arrested for an OWI type of offense. That law and enforcement wants a sample for testing. If you refuse, your license is going to be revoked. If you comply and you're over the limit, your license will be suspended. And if you take the test, you can also take more tests at your own expense. Under sub 9A, if the person refuses testing, which actually means withdrawing his consent to testing, which he has already given, then the officer prepares a notice of intent to revoke. That says that before the officer asked for the sample, you were placed under arrest for an OWI-related offense. The officer read you the information, you refused, and that you can ask for a hearing. And then it says that at the hearing, there are only certain issues, and it's quite clear. It is whether the officer had probable cause to believe that you had violated one of these offenses, whether you were lawfully placed under arrest for one of those offenses, whether the officer read the information, whether you refused, and whether you were incapable of submitting. So it all kind of flows together, and none of it has anything to do with anything that happens prior to the arrest.
Counsel, let me give you a hypothetical. A person refuses to take the test, as this person did. And so he is subject to the procedures and the penalties under the statute. Okay, so, but when the OWI is prosecuted for a totally different reason, the prosecution fails. So he doesn't get a conviction for OWI. Does he still have the suspension that goes along with the refusal?
Well, it's a revocation, but yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fine. Under sub 8, if the person takes the test and it comes back that he's, say, 0.10, and then his license is suspended, he can then have an administrative hearing. If he loses that, well, he can then have that hearing. If he loses there, then his license is suspended. He can then, at the trial for the drunk driving, still challenge it. And if it turns out that a jury finds him not guilty, or if the state throws out the charges and just chooses not to try it, then the court can purge it. And his suspension is purged, so he doesn't lose anything. The point is that you're supposed to take the test.
Okay, well, let me, just to be sure I understand you. So if he violates the refusal standards mm-hmm. under the statute and what you're arguing today, mm-hmm. so he gets revoked, suspended of his license
yes.
according to the, mm-hmm. the statute. Then when the drunk driving charge is proceeded upon, for whatever reason, mm-hmm. he's not found guilty and the charge is dismissed. What is the effect on his license then?
He's going to lose his license for at least 6 months. Mm-hmm. And if he gets an OWI at some point in the future, mm-hmm. this refusal counts okay. as a past offense.
See, and I think that that's opposing counsel's position, that if you don't get to litigate that the stop was not valid, there was no reasonable suspicion, you could have someone who really wasn't driving well intoxicated, or something else happens that the state can't prove their case, and he's charged and convicted essentially as though he were. But if, in fact, the stop wasn't valid in and of itself, you couldn't even do a Terry stop here, just say that's the example, then the person has no relief if you can't litigate it at this stage of the proceeding. When you get to the second stage, it isn't necessarily help you out of the problems you got into in the first stage if you were not driving under the influence anyway, right? So the only way you can get underneath the revocation from the refusal is by being able to challenge whether the stop itself was lawful to start with, right?
Well, that's true, but I don't think that is contrary to the intent of the statute.
Yeah, well,
the intent of the statute is take the test.
Yeah, no,
the,
I agree.
The goal of the law, the entire goal, as this court has said many times, and the Court of Appeals has said many, many more times, is to help the officer to collect evidence to get drunk drivers off the road and to secure convictions of drunk drivers. So if you're asked to take the test and you take the test, even if you're over,
well, just say you don't take the test because that's where we are.
Here, I mean, don't you have a constitutional right not to be stopped by an officer whenever he decides he doesn't like the car you're driving or the way you got your hair fixed or whatever?
I don't think this really comes, that comes into this in the refusal context. If the goal is to stop officers from stopping cars for no reason, that comes into the suppression hearing. And as long as you take the test, it doesn't even come into play.
It doesn't give you any relief in the hypothetical that I put to you, because if he was not driving OWI or whatever reason the charges are dismissed, he still has got the revocation. And if he was stopped lawfully, there's no relief for that unlawful stop.
And that's why the goal of the statute is to make you take the test.
Yeah.
You don't have that option. If you take the test, even if you're over, if you win later at the drunk driving, or if the charges are thrown out for any reason, you then don't have anything.
And the purpose
is take the test.
Now do you have an answer for why refusals might tag along with an OWI and the OWI be dispensed with first, typically, before someone determines if they want a hearing on a refusal?
I suppose if you lose at the drunk driving, you're not going to ask for the hearing.
And if you win at the drunk driving?
Well, then there's a reasonable chance that you're going to win at the refusal.
And
you might not, depending on exactly why.
If you lose at the refusal, you've already got one strike against you, regardless of how the drunk driving comes out.
Sure.
So there'd be incentive to not really have a refusal hearing unless you really think you're going to.
I think that's true.
The downside's greater than the upside.
And from what the Court of Appeals has done here, you would basically have a suppression hearing as a refusal hearing, and then you can have a second suppression hearing later on the drunk driving. And I don't think that's what the legislature intended in the way that the statute works.
Why are you reading the word lawfully out of 5A?
It
doesn't say when the person was placed under arrest. It says when the person was lawfully placed under arrest. So you have to decide whether it's lawful. That's not the usual rule in the law, that you look just at the 30 seconds of placing under arrest to see if it's lawful. You look at the whole thing to see if it's lawful. I think you're reading lawfully out of the statute.
Well, this court has done exactly that in State v. Nordness and Washburn County v. Smith. It hasn't said that this adds some extra thing. It's basically in addition to that, there are a few statutes which use that term. Specifically, one is 968.10, dealing with search and seizures when authorized, and it says, a search of a person, object, or place may be made and things may be seized when the search is made incident to a lawful arrest. The Court of Appeals has held in a case named State v. King, 142 with second 207, that the addition of that word adds nothing. It doesn't mean anything but an arrest, so that it means if you have been arrested, if the search is incident to an arrest, that's the same thing as saying search incident to a lawful arrest.
That's right. And so if you're talking about a search incident to arrest, you can attack the legality of the arrest, right? I agree with you. Arrest means lawful arrest.
Mm-hmm.
So whether you had lawful in there or not, still be able to attack whether the arrest was lawful, because by definition we're talking about a lawful arrest. Now, Nordness is not directly controlling. Nordness repeated the statute, but the issue in Nordness was not the issue in this case.
I do not agree. I think it was exactly the same.
Wasn't the issue that whether he could say he wasn't driving the car?
Yes, and the court found that even something that obvious and basic does not come into this statute.
That's right.
But what the court said is it was going to determine what are the issues at a refusal hearing. And it mentioned nothing about whether the officer had reasonable suspicion to stop.
Well, because that wasn't the issue.
But it said, here are the issues.
Right.
And it read the statute and said, here are the only issues, and that isn't one of them.
Well, isn't arrest one of them? That the court said,
sure.
That's this case?
No, because he actually was arrested in this case.
Lawfully is the issue here.
Sure. The officer had probable cause to arrest him, and he did all of those things necessary to arrest him. I think, and if I can add one thing, my light's on.
You have one thing, Mr. Sander, and then you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Sure. When I looked at Nordness, what I was really citing was at page 28, where the court talked about what the issues are. And it said the issues in the hearing are specifically limited to whether the officer had probable cause to believe the person was driving under the influence of alcohol, blah, blah, blah. It did not mention whether the person was lawfully placed under arrest. And I was a little troubled by that because I think that the statute clearly says that. But if you read, once I read it more closely, what the court really said was, for example, a person who has been arrested for driving under the influence may be requested to submit to testing. In that circumstance, the issues are whether the officer had probable cause. Right there, the court said, if the person was arrested for driving while under the influence, that's what the statute contemplates. Mm-hmm. It didn't say anything about the underlying basis for the arrest, mm-hmm. or whether the stop was valid, mm-hmm. or whether the officer had PC to request field tests, or whether the officer had PC to ask for a PBT. Mm-hmm. It said simply whether the person was arrested. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's all the statute contemplates.
Well, that's all the statute says. Statute doesn't say anymore, but the question is, what does arrest mean and whether it's lawful? And we can differ or not differ. We'll hear what Mr. Cohen has to say. Barry S. Cohen, counsel for the defendant. Mr. Cohen.
Chief Justice Abrahamson, Justices, may it please the Court. My name is Barry Cohen. I represent Demetrius Anagnos in this appeal. I represented Mr. Anagnos in the Court of Appeals as well, and I represented him in the trial court. When we started the refusal hearing in this case, I told the trial court judge there's only one issue that we were contesting. That's the reasonableness of the stop. I thought that I would be saving everybody a lot of time by trying to narrowly focus the hearing. And I indicated that we were not contesting any of the other issues. I was surprised by the judge's response and series of questions and discussions regarding whether and how we were going to address the issue of the stop. Because my understanding has always been that the lawfulness of a stop can be challenged at a refusal hearing. That leads to the two issues in this case. Was the stop of Mr. Anagnos' vehicle lawful? And second, was the lawfulness of the stop properly considered by the trial court at the refusal hearing? The trial court judge agreed that an unlawful stop cannot be the basis for a valid drunk driving arrest. The state objected, and the court, this is at, and this is in the record, this is at the first hearing in the refusal case. The court queried the prosecutor, "You mean to say that you can have an unlawful stop in violation of someone's constitutional rights, and the evidence obtained after that can then be used to prosecute the person for a refusal and their license be revoked?" The prosecutor responded, "Yes." And that is the state's position here. It hasn't changed. The problem with that is that's not the law.
Can I just ask, why didn't you bring this just in the OWI? Didn't you represent him in that? I know the OWI is not before us, but I'm just curious.
Well, that really brings up the question that you asked earlier. The refusal case here was decided before the drunk driving case ever got addressed by the circuit court. That is, in my experience, and I know, Justice Ziegler, you have done many refusal hearings. Justice Gableman has also done many refusal hearings. I have done many myself. I've been doing this for 29 years now. In my experience, and in almost every case where there's a refusal charge, that refusal charge is decided prior to the litigation and trial of the drunk driving case, because one of the threshold issues at a drunk driving trial where there's a refusal charge is whether or not the evidence of the person's refusal comes in the drunk driving trial. If you have the refusal hearing and the person is found to have unreasonably refused to take the test, they obviously suffer the penalties that Justice Rogensack was referring to, and the evidence of the refusal can be used against the person at the trial. This has to be decided before there's a drunk driving case. Now, in my experience, there are certainly many cases where the refusal charge is pending along with the drunk driving, but those are cases where it's going to be resolved, which is, frankly, in the vast majority of cases, with a plea of guilty to the drunk driving charge and then a corresponding dismissal of the refusal charge. That's how that works.
Or you just have a trial on what the evidence was in the OWI. I mean, he still took a test. Even if you refuse, you still have test results, and the state tries the case based on the test results and leaves all the refusal out of it.
In some cases, if in fact a test was taken, but in a case like we have here, there was an arrest for a civil first offense drunk driving. There was a refusal to take the test, no test taken. And
they didn't take a blood, breath,
correct,
or urine test?
That's correct.
But they charged him with an OWI?
Yes. Well, he first gets charged with drunk driving. This is what's required.
But
first,
not
you
a
get
PAC.
Arrested.
They didn't charge him with a PAC?
Correct, because there was no test result. And in a first
offense.
Why didn't
they take a test? Any idea?
In a first offense drunk driving case, and let me address that directly, but the practice is, in reality, in a first offense drunk driving case, they normally don't do what you'd call a forced blood. They can't do a forced breath test. They can't do a forced urine test, but they could do a forced blood test. Had this, and is the practice, if it's a repeat offense case, in almost all jurisdictions in this state, there's a forced blood test. But why don't they do it? Well, they don't do it because they frankly don't need to. If there's a refusal charge and someone is convicted of a first offense refusal, the drunk driving charge at that point is moot.
Irrelevant, right.
Because the person's already got their license revoked, not for 6 months, but for 12 months in a first offense, which is longer than they lose their license in a drunk driving revocation. And that refusal conviction counts as a drunk driving conviction should there ever be a subsequent arrest. And they got to do the alcohol assessment and that. So really, if there's a refusal charge, and if they're convicted, the drunk driving charge is, for practical purposes, in a first offense moot. And that really, that brings up the issue of Nordness.
Let me ask you this. Do you think it should be different? Do you think we should set out a different rule in first offenses versus second or third offenses when it comes to refusals because of that distinction?
I don't know. I haven't given it any thought, and to me, it has nothing. I mean, I'm not contesting the, you know.
In a first offense, the refusal penalties are actually higher than if you're convicted of the OWI, and going forward, a refusal counts as a first offense OWI.
Yeah, and in repeat drunk driving offenses, the refusal penalties are worse as well. The only difference is that there's no jail sentence. You're not going to go to jail for a second offense charge where you've refused the breath test. You will go to jail if you're convicted of that drunk driving. But if you're convicted of a revocation, of a refusal in a second offense, your driver's license is revoked for longer than it would be in the drunk driving. You automatically get the maximum. And you don't. You have to wait a year to get an occupational license, not 45 days. The reason I wanted to get to Nordness because the state relies on Nordness, 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 and they said that to the trial court judge from day one. Nordness precludes this. Nordness absolutely does not preclude it. The Court of Appeals decision and the trial court decision is entirely consistent with Nordness. People come to my office all the time. They're charged, like Mr. Anagnos, with a first offense drunk driving and a refusal charge. They come in, and let's say it's a jurisdiction where there was, in fact, a forced blood drawn. Person comes in, they're charged with drunk driving, first offense, they show me the blood test result, and it's a .05. They say, clearly, they can't prosecute me for this because I'm under the limit. That's not the case. The fact that you may not have actually been under the influence at the time, that's not a defense to the refusal charge. It's not an issue. That's what Nordness was asking the court to do. Nordness wanted to take an issue from the drunk driving trial, that I wasn't the driver, just like this theoretical client would say. I can't go to the court in a refusal hearing and ask the court to make a finding that because my client was not under the influence, you can't prosecute him or convict him for refusal. That's not going anywhere. I have to tell this potential client, those may be issues for the drunk driving trial, but they're not defenses for a refusal case. Anagnos, this case is not Nordness because Mr. Anagnos is not asking this court to create another issue. The issue of whether he was lawfully placed under arrest is an issue and has been an issue under 343.3059 for at least 30 years, as far as I can see, certainly going back to the Welsh versus Wisconsin case. That was
why is Welsh important? The state says Welsh is irrelevant.
I don't know why the state says Welsh is irrelevant.
Why do you think it's important?
Well, the United States Supreme Court took the Welsh case, which we all remember the Welsh, and I know this court's very familiar with the holding in Welsh. But the Welsh case, Welsh was charged with a first offense refusal, just like Mr. Anagnos. The U.S. Supreme Court took that case, examined our implied consent law, and determined that if the arrest was based upon a Fourth Amendment illegal seizure, a Fourth Amendment violation, under Wisconsin's implied consent law, it's not a lawful arrest, and the United States Supreme Court reversed Welsh's driver license revocation in his refusal case. Nordness.
Well, are we bound by the U.S. Supreme Court interpretation of our law?
I don't know. They clearly had the same law that whether lawful arrest is required in a refusal case. They clearly decided that, examining Wisconsin's law. To finish with Nordness, Nordness was arrested legally. There was reasonable suspicion to arrest him. There was to stop his vehicle, there was probable cause to arrest him, and he was arrested legally, regardless of whether or not he was the actual driver of the vehicle. Mr. Anagnos was not arrested lawfully. He was stopped without reasonable suspicion and without probable cause. That's the difference, and if this court affirms the decision from the Court of Appeals, it need do nothing with regard to its decision in Nordness. Affirming this decision from the Court of Appeals does not in any way affect Nordness. It doesn't change anything. It doesn't add any issues to the refusal case. When the court hears a refusal case, the officer starts with the testimony of when the officer first comes upon the driver, wherever and however that may be. The refusal hearing does not start, as suggested by the state.
So I want to shift your focus a little bit before your time runs out to another issue, and that is whether there was probable cause to stop the defendant in this case. When I read the Court of Appeals and the parts of the trial court's record that I've looked at, it appears that both courts relied on a belief that he didn't violate any law, so therefore there wasn't reasonable suspicion. But, of course, if he had violated a law, he'd have probable cause. So why isn't the conduct that occurred from when the officer first saw the defendant leaving the Taco Bell until the time of the arrest sufficient for probable cause in your view?
Both courts found that there was no probable cause to believe that Anagnos had violated any law, and both courts found that there was no reasonable suspicion to believe that he was operating while intoxicated. The Court of Appeals, in examining the trial court's findings, specifically found that there were no articulable facts, and I'm quoting from the Court of Appeals decision, no specific and articulable facts to justify a reasonable suspicion Terry stop. The Court of Appeals went through the trial court's findings, which were extensive. The trial court made findings, thick. And the Court of Appeals found the trial court's findings to be not clearly erroneous and clearly supported by the record.
I think they both relied, though, Counselor, quite a bit on the officers thinking the divider that he drove over was 5 inches and it was 1.5 to 2 inches, and the fact that driving over it didn't break a law. Well, all of those may be findings, but I think there's a lot of case law that says what we have to look at is what the officer reasonably believed.
Clearly.
And I don't know why he couldn't reasonably believe that the divider was 5 inches rather than 1.5 or 2 inches.
The trial court made findings regarding that.
But you don't need a law to be broken in order to pull someone over at a Terry stop to have reasonable suspicion. You just need erratic driving or some unusual circumstances or some. It's a lot less than probable cause to arrest. We kind of throw around these terms like probable cause and reasonable suspicion, but probable cause to arrest is significantly different than whether someone's driving erratically. They don't have to violate any law. Sometimes people going too slow is reasonable suspicion to stop.
Let me just finish your question, and Justice Rodenstein, I'll get right to you. The problem in this case is that, yes, I certainly concede that an officer can stop a motorist without observing any violation of law, which would give the officer probable cause to make that stop. An officer can make a stop based on reasonable suspicion if the officer can articulate facts that would lead a reasonable officer to believe that there's illegal conduct taking place in some fashion. Well, the problem is, and we refer to all of those articulable facts as building blocks, the problem is there aren't any building blocks in this case. He exited a Taco Bell, not a bar. He crossed a median that the trial court found was a legal turn. He accelerated up to a stop sign and made a stop. He made a left turn from the stoplight without using a signal that the trial court found was legal. There was no other traffic that was affected. There was no requirement that he use a signal. He makes a left turn. He accelerates, and the officer stops him. There are no building blocks in this case. There is, and the trial court and the Court of Appeals both found there was no probable cause that the officer had to believe a violation and no reasonable suspicion. I want to answer your question, Justice Rogan-Sack, as to why the trial court judge, or why couldn't the officer just believe? Clearly, the officer believed, that was his testimony, he believed that Anagnos jumped a 5-inch curb when he crossed that median.
Right.
And the officer can stop a vehicle if he has probable cause to believe.
Or reasonable suspicion.
Well, yes, but if what he's stopping the vehicle for, if the basis is a violation of law, that's probable cause.
Well, it is and it isn't, Counselor. I mean, he doesn't have to go out there and have measured the divider. Then he would have probable cause to believe he was jumping something that was... Maybe you can jump a 5-inch curb. I don't have any idea, to be honest with you.
I rely on Justice Ziegler's discussion of probable cause in the Popke case, which extensively...
Probable cause is not my problem. My problem really is reasonable suspicion.
Well, the trial court made specific findings regarding why the officer's belief, albeit mistaken, was unreasonable.
Let me tell you what's bothering me. If you see someone comes out of a restaurant, doesn't have to be a bar, quickly goes up over a curb and down the opposite direction on the street, you can take their conduct as something that someone normally wouldn't do and watch them a little bit further. He accelerated very rapidly, came to a stop at the stop sign, turned left, and took off very quickly again. The officer seeing that and believing that going over that curb is unlawful would think that a reasonable person who wasn't operating under the influence wouldn't make those choices. So you have the combination of his belief that the curb was higher than it was, that it was unlawful to jump it, which it may not have been, even at 5 inches. But what I read him as trying to articulate was trying to say why he thought the way he exited the Taco Bell and the way he stopped and then quickly took off again indicated reasonable suspicion to believe that he was probably drunk. And so, it wasn't probable cause that he violated the law so much as the officer's belief that someone who was operating without being under the influence wouldn't have made the choices he made. Now, the officer did think that doing what he did was unlawful, and the trial court put that aside and also put aside the lack of a signal. But the officer wasn't stopping him for those things. It made the officer believe he was operating under the influence. Do you see the difference I'm trying to draw?
I do, but in this case, Justice Rogan-Sack, the trial court made a specific finding that there was no testimony by the officer. There was no testimony that he stopped. No testimony that he stopped Anagnos because he suspected him of driving under the influence. And the trial court also found there was no testimony of even why the officer stopped Mr. Anagnos in the first place. There was no testimony regarding any of that. We can't read that into the record.
No, I'll go back and read it again. But thank you.
Counsel, I have a practical question. It's similar to the line of questioning Chief Justice Abramson was asking. If lawful arrest means more than take a look at whether there's probable cause to arrest, if it means dig deeper and find out whether there was reasonable suspicion to stop in the first instance, where's the stopping point? If I'm a defendant and I say, there's no probable cause to arrest me because I wasn't driving, or there's no probable cause to arrest me because I did fine on the field sobriety test, or there's no probable cause to arrest me for a whole host of reasons that come up as defenses in drunk driving, isn't that having a trial within a trial for a refusal hearing?
Well,
If all those, a person who wasn't the driver is not necessarily lawfully arrested. They shouldn't have been arrested if you're not the driver.
If the officer had probable cause to believe the person was a driver, that's it. You can stand on your head and say to the trial court judge 17 times, I wasn't the driver.
Okay. So
Even matter if the judge believes you weren't the driver. If the officer had probable cause, End of analysis.
Okay. So if I say I did great on the field sobriety tests, and because I did so well, you don't have probable cause to arrest me, officer. So the judge is going to have a trial on how the field sobriety tests went?
Plausibility is the standard, as the state pointed out. If the officer's version with regard to probable cause to arrest, if it's plausible, then you don't get into that weighing of credibility, I guess.
So in your view, the only issue really at a refusal hearing that you dig down on from the probable cause to arrest is whether there's a reasonable suspicion to stop?
No. The probable cause for the arrest encompasses whether the stop was lawful and everything else that led up to the arrest, the field sobriety tests and all that sort of stuff in a case. It's all regularly heard by trial court judges in deciding the issues at a refusal hearing. I'm not asking that anything different be done. That's the way it's...
If the officer believed that driving over this curb was unlawful, and if that was the reason he stopped him, why isn't that reasonable suspicion?
Well, the officer did believe that.
Right. Why isn't
the problem
that reasonable suspicion to stop him?
Because if he believes he observed a violation of law,
right,
that's probable cause to believe. That's,
well, it can be reasonable suspicion if he's not 100%
well,
sure. He hasn't checked the size of the curve.
Either one involve a test of reasonableness.
Right. Okay, and I want to know why isn't that reasonable if the officer believes.
Because him. When you consider the reasonableness, the judge looks at the totality of the circumstances in deciding whether a reasonable officer could have had that belief. In this case, we have a trial court judge who made findings as to why it's not reasonable officer.
He said it's not unlawful. That was the judge's reason.
But he made further findings as to why a reasonable officer wouldn't have believed that. Because, number one, the trial court found that the defendant measured the median. It was an inch and a half. The state didn't contradict it. It's very common that you go over barriers like that. The trial court said, I don't know how the officer could have believed, and I'm citing from 217 at the record, the officer believed the median was a 5-inch perpendicular curb, something you clearly could not do. If it was 5 inches high, it would have caused a real crunch of that vehicle to try to get over it. The court further finds at 222, there was no claim by the officer. This is significant. There is no claim by the officer that he saw any excessive jolt as the car hit this curb or do anything. So the court considers the totality of the circumstances in deciding whether the officer's belief was reasonable. I concede the officer believed it. We all know he was mistaken.
What if the officer thought that driving over a 2-inch curb was unlawful?
That's
why would that not be reasonable?
That's a mistake of law.
Well, yeah, but we're talking about reasonable suspicion to stop someone. Why? And we're talking about whether his belief was reasonable. So if he believed that was the law, why isn't that sufficient for a reasonable suspicion Terry type stop?
If the officer believed that it's against the law to drive across a 2-inch high median, which basically is what we had here, that is a mistake of the law. There's no law that prohibits that. And Longcore, State versus Longcore, says you can't have a stop by an officer based on a mistake of law. So that doesn't fly.
State versus Longcore?
Longcore.
Okay. Counsel? Part of your discussion earlier in arguments was focused on this is a first offense. This is a first offense. You were asked a question about how this affects multiple offenses, and you again, you paused and said this is a first offense. And yet the way that we interpret the statute, of course, applies to more than just first offense. So how can you argue that this case should be limited to first offenses?
I'm not arguing that it should be limited to first offenses in any way. The refusal statute, the issues at the hearing apply regardless of what offense OWI it is. I'm not suggesting that this holding applies to first offense cases in any way.
Then I missed something in terms of your argument that, look, in first offenses, the penalty is actually more severe. And, of course, you can be It can be used as a OWI for purposes of counting subsequent offenses. So what's that argument? I'm missing that argument.
Well,
that if you're not advancing.
That's not part of my argument as to why this should be affirmed or not. I discussed that because it was an issue, a question that was raised by Justice Ziegler, and I was simply addressing that. It doesn't make any difference in this case. It doesn't make any difference as far as this holding. You look at the Court of Appeals holding, it doesn't matter if it's a first offense, a fourth offense, or whatever. The issues, it's the same refusal law. Our implied consent law is the same regardless of whether the person has a prior offense or not. The issues at the hearing are the same. So there is nothing about this holding that applies any more or less in a first offense case or any other case.
Counsel, suppose you lose. What's the remedy?
Suppose
you lose and the court says this was a lawful arrest, reasonable suspicion. What happens next?
It'll get remanded and the trial court will reverse its decision and revoke Mr. Anagnos' driver's license for 12 months. And order him.
This came up here on a stipulation, right?
Excuse me?
You and the state stipulated about some matters in order to bring this case here, didn't you? So my question really is that stipulation still in effect, even if you lose?
I think what you're referring to when you say that we stipulated to certain things, I indicated that when we started the refusal hearing, I said there's only one issue. We are stipulating for purposes of the refusal case. We're not contesting that he was read the form right and that he didn't have any reason he couldn't take the blood test. That's all we stipulated to, and we had the hearing, and that was decided. So there isn't – I mean, we're not going to go back and relitigate. We're bound by that stipulation.
You're bound by the stipulation.
Sure.
Fine. And the only issue was reasonable suspicion for purposes of arrest –
the lawfulness of the stop for purposes of arrest,
right.
That's right.
And you lose on that, the end.
And I acknowledge that to the trial court at the very first hearing, that everything rises or falls in this refusal case on whether or not the stop was lawful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cohn. Mr. Sanders?
On the last part, I would agree that in this case, it all rises and falls on whether the arrest was lawful. And since it was, and he stipulated to everything else, he's going to lose his license. And that's what the statute contemplates. You're supposed to take the test. He didn't. So he has nothing else, and he's going to lose. If this court finds the way that I want it to, I didn't mean to imply. In terms of the issue as to whether the officer actually had reasonable suspicion or probable cause to stop, I think it's true that the officer had reasonable suspicion to stop the vehicle based on the totality of the circumstances. I also think that if you read 346.15, the defendant here broke the law. The court viewed it as a question of how tall the median is, but that's not what the statute said. I tried to lay it out in my two briefs, and the way the statute reads, it's the driving on a divided highway statute, and it says if there is a barrier that was constructed to substantially impede vehicular traffic, you cannot cross it under any circumstance. It doesn't matter if there's a sign. It doesn't matter if it's safe. It doesn't matter if you're leaving if you left a Taco Bell at 2:30 in the morning drunk. You can't cross it. It says if the barrier was not constructed to impede traffic, you can cross it if there's not a sign that says you can't. In this case, there isn't a sign. But if you look at the photographs, which I appended in a supplemental appendix that the court has, and which is in the appellate record, I don't think there's any way to view this as this median being something that was not constructed to impede traffic. It splits three lanes going north from two lanes going south. It's a full median, which is 5'8" wide, with a 2-inch curb, and it blocks people from coming out of Taco Bell to cross five lanes of traffic. it's clearly meant to impede traffic. And I don't think the court actually found that it wasn't meant to impede traffic. I think the court misinterpreted what the statute said. The court said something along the lines of, if that, according to the statute, if you can turn safely, and if your turn wouldn't impede traffic, you can do it. That's not what the statute says. The focus is not on the turn, it's on the actual median. And it says if the median was constructed to substantially impede traffic, you can't cross it. He crossed it, and the officer saw it. It doesn't matter that it was 2 inches. It matters that it's there to impede traffic from crossing. What it actually means, if it wasn't, was that any car going down that road, north and south, next to the median, could cross it at any point. Not at the opening, where there's an opening to turn. You could just cross it at any point to either turn left or do a U-turn. Clearly, that's not what this is about. It was there to stop traffic. He crossed it, he broke the law, and the officer saw it. And I think that's really what it comes down to on that issue. In terms of the other issues on the main issue, I guess, in the case, that the revocation is actually longer for a refusal than it is for a first offense drunk driving just shows how important it is that you don't refuse. When the law was passed, they made it worse. The goal and the purpose is to take the test. It's to help officers, and they are helped if you take the test because then they can get evidence. And as counsel pointed out, in many first offenses, the state isn't going to draw blood if the defendant won't do it. So if the refusal is gone, there may not be any evidence. And that's the point, too, is you're supposed to take the test. In terms of distinguishing Nordness, I know the court tried to, but the way that it did it I don't think really makes sense. It said that in that case, the officers had reasonable suspicion to make the stop. But there's not a word in that case where the court in Nordness found that there was reasonable suspicion to make the stop. It didn't come up because it doesn't matter under that statute. And I think importantly, in Nordness, the court lays out what the four issues are and then says, but in this case, three of them were actually stipulated to. So there's really only one issue. So the court laid out issues that weren't really at issue in that case. It laid out all the issues and then said, but in this particular case, based on our facts, it's only one issue. If it really meant that there are more issues, it would have said that, and it chose not to. So I think it's pretty clear that it laid out all the issues, and there's no way to distinguish it, as the Court of Appeals tried to. And if this court is going to affirm, it has to really say that it was wrong in that case.
Mr. Sanders, thank you for your rebuttal and your main argument. Mr. Cohen, thank you for yours and your briefs in a case involving a refusal to take the test. That completes our argument in 10 AP 1812, State versus Demetrius Anagnos. That completes all our scheduled arguments for April. The April calendar is completed, and the court is adjourned. The court will meet in conference at 1:45, and I will be out to talk with the students in a few moments. We are adjourned.